6AP506, Joseph Blunt Sr. versus Medtronic Inc. We'll now have 20 minutes from counsel for the Blunts, 5 minutes followed by Mr. Gleisner, who represents the Wisconsin Association of Justice, the amicus. We will then have 30 minutes from Michael Brown, who will be introduced by Robert Friedberg. Counsel, you may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, I'm John Cabanis. I represent Joe and Margaret Blunt. I'm privileged to be here to present their case today, and it's a special privilege to be here in the Winnebago County Courthouse. The Blunts ask you today to reverse and remand this case so they can try their case for damages in the circuit court. They ask you to reverse the case so they can try their claim that Medtronic sold an obsolete defibrillator with an unsafe battery 7 months after it received FDA approval for a defibrillator with a safe battery. Medtronic argues that the United States Supreme Court decision last term in Regal v. Medtronic provides it a get-out-of-jail-free card in this case, that no matter how obsolete the product, the device, no matter how many safety improvements have been made to that device, no matter how many people have been injured or killed, no matter how unreasonable their conduct, that there's preemption and the Blunts cannot bring a state tort claim for Medtronic's decision, their election, to sell an obsolete device with an unsafe battery after having received pre-market approval. That's not the law of Regal. That's not the law of Lohr. It's not the law or the analysis of the federal courts of appeals that have applied a preemption analysis. In Regal, the Supreme Court considered the preemptive effect of the express preemption provision 360KA. And that provision provides that the state cannot establish a requirement that's different from or in addition to a federal requirement. And the focus in that case, as most of the preemption cases, was on the inclusion in the statute, in the express preemption provision, of the word requirement. And what the court held in Regal is that the word requirement not only includes state regulatory law, but it also includes state case law.
Mr. Cabanis, if I can interrupt you for a moment, how does the recall in regard to the battery fit into all of this?
In terms of the fact that they did recall it?
Well, and also time sequence-wise.
Well, I think the importance for the issues this court is addressing is that in December of 2002, the FDA approved a supplemental premarket approval application for the defibrillator with the CHI battery. Subsequently, in October of 2003, the FDA approved, again, a supplemental premarket approval application for the same defibrillator, exactly the same, but with a safer, updated battery. And that was in October of 2003. Mr. Blunt had his obsolete defibrillator with the unsafe battery implanted in May of 2004, 7 months after Medtronic had sought and obtained premarket approval for this updated, improved, safer defibrillator.
So now it had two premarket approvals.
Correct.
One for each of these batteries.
Correct. And just to talk a little bit about the process, we're talking about supplemental approvals. 21 CFR 814.39 governs supplemental approvals. Whenever a manufacturer has a brand new device, they have to go through the full pre-market approval process, disclose all their data to the FDA, and get approval to sell the device. But what we're talking about here is the company going back on a single device and saying, we want to make this update or this change for various reasons. The PMA that initially approved this defibrillator with the CHI battery was the 23rd supplement to the original PMA. The approval of the PMA to improve the battery and address this battery shorting problem and this unsafe problem with the prior battery was the 29th supplemental approval. So on that supplemental approval, they just went in and said, we know we have a problem with this battery. It can short, so we want to update, we want to improve it. And the FDA made that approval, said, great, you're approved, go sell it with the updated safer battery.
When does the recall occur?
The recall then was actually in the, I want to get my years right, the spring of 05, March of 05. So I think for the purposes we're arguing today, I don't think the recall is necessarily a critical fact for the court's determination. It really is. The issue is, applying Regal in the preemption analysis, was Medtronic required, when it chose to clean out its inventory 7 months after it had approval for the updated device with a safer battery, was it required to sell its old inventory? No. They weren't required to. They elected to. And
Mr. Cavanaugh, is there anything in the record to indicate that Medtronic had ever acted inconsistently with any of the requirements imposed by the original PMA?
Well, in terms of the original PMA, it didn't authorize the battery we're talking about. So, you know, that battery, the CHI battery, was a supplemental PMA.
Right, but they had received the original approval.
Correct.
And that approval, based on my reading of the record, had never been removed.
Absolutely true. And the question is, the fact that they were permitted to sell the old device, the fact is the FDA didn't recall it until in spring of 05. But in terms of when they sold the obsolete defibrillator that was implanted in Mr. Blunt, it had not been recalled through that day.
You say obsolete, but it had the FDA approval.
Correct. But the reason I say obsolete is the whole premise of the PMA supplement process is that you're going to improve products and you're going to come in and tell us and we're going to approve changes to make the product safe.
And that happened here.
But was, if the question is, Justice, was Medtronic permitted to sell this older device, I say with an unsafe battery, perhaps somebody else say not as good a battery, were they permitted to? Absolutely. By federal law, they were permitted to because it hadn't been recalled by that point. But I would argue that the federal law, the federal regulations, did not require them to sell this older device. They elected to clean out their inventory. And it's that decision to sell, I say, the older unsafe device that I submit to you we can bring a viable tort claim in the Wisconsin courts. Because again, the whole premise of preemption is based on the word in the statute, requirement. And they were not required to sell these older devices.
Well, will you discuss your theory in light of the Supreme Court's decision in, I think it's Geier, G-E-I-E-R, versus Honda American Motors? Because there were two products there for restraint in automobiles that the FDA had approved. Now, it's a different statutory set, but what I'm trying to understand is your claim that once a new product had been approved, then the old product really wasn't a federal requirement. That's what you're essentially telling us. And can you discuss it in light of here, where there were two products, the newer product being the airbags, the older product being the lap and shoulder restraint?
The difference is, Your Honor, the NHTSA had extensively considered and reviewed the relative efficacy of restraint systems and airbags, and to promote the use of both did not make a definitive determination of which way a manufacturer could go. And so, given the fact that the NHTSA had considered the issues, preemption was found. Here, the FDA never considered or evaluated whether or not it was appropriate for Medtronic to sell these older devices with the outdated, unsafe battery. That was not a consideration.
Well, apparently neither the, they did when they recalled it. Isn't that what they considered when they recalled it? And wasn't that the basis of the recall?
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Yeah, at that point they did. But they did not in advance of the implantation into Mr. Blunt. And if you look at the regulations in terms of the whole notion of PMA supplements, query, can Medtronic or another manufacturer, go back 30 years, sell out of its inventory a product that is clearly outdated, clearly unsafe, or sell it in the third world to make profit because it's sitting in their locker, just because the FDA hadn't considered, evaluated whether or not that would still make sense. The reality is there's an assumption in the whole PMA supplement process that if you go into the FDA and you say, we recognize we've got a battery that may short out, not be there to save somebody if they have a cardiac incident, I think it's implicit in the process that they anticipate that that application has been made so the change can be implemented. And the notion that a manufacturer would continue to sell their inventory for 7 months.
Mr. Cavanaugh.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. You have a claim for strict product liability?
As well as negligence, Your Honor. Okay.
When would that claim for strict product liability have arisen?
It's a very good question, Your Honor, and in preparing for this debate or discussion, I do concede
right.
debate. I do concede that the claim we're arguing really sounds more in negligence, that it was the company's conduct in making the decision post-PMA approval more than the strict liability theory itself that is at play. So I would argue that negligence principally came into play following pre-market approval for the improved device, the safer battery, when Medtronic opted to sell the defibrillators with the outdated battery.
Well, we know the PMA for the product that you're concerned about was December 17, 2002.
The original. When they went to the Chai battery,
yeah,
the PMA right. supplemental approval, yes, sir.
And then the new PMA is October 23rd, 2003.
Correct.
Does your negligence claim arise on October 6, 2003, when they submitted something for the new PMA, or October 23rd? Or
23rd.
23rd.
Not until there's PMA approval.
So every person who, how would you phrase it? Every sale after that time?
I would say every sale after that time.
Suppose someone acquired the product the 21st of October for subsequent surgery. Is that covered?
I think they get a get out of jail free card, and in fact, if you look at the California Court of Appeals case which is Scott v. Sibba, I believe, in your materials. That involved, I don't wear contacts, but contact lens solution. And really what happened there was just what you posit, and that is an injury occurred almost simultaneously with a change in some labeling for some contact lens solution. And I think that they get a get-out-of-jail-free card prior to the date of the PMA approval based on Regal and the last-term decision of the U.S. Supreme Court. It's once they have the approval to sell the new battery that they, and when they made the conscious decision to sell, to get rid of their inventory, that I submit to you the Blunts have a right to go forward with that claim.
Well, we've got this product, and you say it is negligence to sell this product after October 23rd, 2003. Why wouldn't it be negligence if I made the product, I sold it the 21st of October, I know she has the product. Why did she acquire the product? She's going to use that product for someone. Why isn't that negligence?
Because the United States Supreme Court in Regal says it's not. I think it does mean.
It's not whether it's negligence. It's whether the cause of action is preempted by the federal statute.
Correct. It's whether it's actionable. I think it is just as negligent. And I think you're putting doctors in a heck of a position. But the Supreme Court's decided that issue. So I can't argue that. I mean, I have my own feelings about the preemption provision and its history and everything else, but the United States Supreme Court has made clear that the word requirement in the express preemption provision includes tort law. I don't agree with that decision respectfully, but it's the law of the land and we're bound by it. And I do think it would be as negligent for a company to make that sale 5 days before when they know, but it is not actionable under Regal.
I have a question. Are you relying on Justice Ginsburg's footnote 1 in her dissent?
I don't recall it offhand, but I have.
I can read it to you.
Regal right here. Let me.
The court's holding does not reach an important issue outside the bounds of this case. The preemptive effect of 360KA, where evidence of a medical device's defect comes to light only after the device receives pre-market approval.
Absolutely.
Okay. Did the FDA err in its regulatory responsibilities when it approves a supplement and doesn't demand that the first device, which the company admits has problems, isn't taken off the market or isn't recalled or isn't, you don't, can they rescind the first pre-market approval?
Could they issue a recall? Yes. Could they rescind it? I'm sure the FDA could, but the whole philosophy of the regulations is that the FDA does work cooperatively with manufacturers, and they try to work on these issues, and oftentimes, just like happened here, initially there was a voluntary recall in effect where a letter went out to doctors and said, we've got a potential problem here, be aware of it. And I think the FDA, in exercising its congressional mandate, really goes through a hierarchy. And the recall bullet is the last bullet in the barrel, if you will. And I don't want to stand up and say they were wrong in the way they exercised their approach here. And I think it's okay for the FDA to assume that companies are going to exercise good faith, and I think this is not a typical situation where a company gets an approval and then clears out its inventory.
Counselor, is there anything in any regulation or your interpretation of the words of the statute that would cause us to conclude just from statutory interpretation that one a supplemental approval revokes or somehow rescinds earlier approvals given?
Could you ask the end of that question?
Yeah.
I didn't hear that.
Yeah.
Supplemental.
Is there anything in either the regulations that are at issue here or the statute itself that would cause us to conclude that a supplemental approval of a Class 3 device like this would, by just by the force of giving the supplemental approval, rescind the approval given to the earlier device?
I'm not aware of any regulation that provides that, or any law, law or regulation that addresses this situation. And I think Medtronic's argument is implicit in the recall power is they could do something, therefore it's fair to assume they approved of this. And so I think that's where the issue is joined. I say in the absence of any action, applying Regal and the 360KA approach, they were permitted to sell the old device but not required. And because they're not required and because they elected to, they're still subject to a tort claim.
See, but when you say they're not required to, pre-market approval gives a requirement. But your argument is that they're not required to, and that was really the basis for my question to you. If we're looking at the statute and we're interpreting the word required, if you're telling me that when they get the supplemental approval, they're no longer, quote, required, then what you're saying is the supplemental approval rescinds the prior requirement, correct?
Supersedes is the word I would use, Your Honor. Clearly, the supplemental process of 81439, and that's 21 CFR, sets forth the procedure that the company should go through, and it clearly requires that when the company recognizes a safety issue or efficacy issue or labeling issue, they have to come in for these Class 3 devices and obtain approval to make the changes. So I would say it supersedes.
Well, whatever word you want to tag on it, it's a very broad holding that you're asking for. Because what you're saying is the requirement ceases to exist for the first device when the supplemental approval is given for the second. And requirement is the statutory term of art that causes these manufacturers to have to sell in compliance with the FDA pre-market approval specifications, correct? And this would go to anybody that does a supplemental approval of a pre-approved device or other, it doesn't have to be a Class 3, but others that apply this same regulatory system. Isn't that right?
Just Class 3. No, I don't totally agree.
Okay.
And what I would say briefly, I know my
time
is up, is that when they
initially answer the question.
When they initially got the PMA approval,
They
were required to market it that way and
That's
to sell it that way.
I understand.
And when they went in for the supplement and said, we've got a bad battery, we want to update it, and they got approval for the updated device, they were no longer required to sell that old device.
And
are they permitted to sell that device, the older one?
But the fact that
they're permitted under the law, but my argument is that they should be potentially held accountable under state tort law for that elective decision.
Okay.
Counsel, if I may, just briefly.
Sure.
At page 1005 of Regal, right before Section B, there's some language in the Supreme Court decision. Take a look at that. Maybe when you come back up on rebuttal, see how you reconcile that language with your argument.
Okay.
If you would, please.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel. Mr. Leisner.
Madam Chief Justice, honorable members of the court, may it please the court. I'm Attorney Bill Gleisner, and I'm appearing today on behalf of the Wisconsin Association for Justice, formerly the Wisconsin Academy of Trial Lawyers. To us, this case is not just about whether or not federal law preempts tort remedies in Wisconsin. Political winds blow from different directions at different times, sometimes very suddenly. Those who are seeking preemption today may just as strenuously a few months from now be seeking preemption, seeking relief from preemption. Who knows? What we are interested in is establishing a preemption test which will be neutral in terms of the parameters it sets up and that will be sufficient to protect Wisconsin, its citizens, and its laws under our federalist system of government. First, with regard to Regal, the association would like to point out Yes, Justice Scalia says in Regal that, quote, state requirements are preempted under the MDA only to the extent they are different from or in addition to the requirements of federal law. However, at pages 1010 to 1011 of Regal, Justice Scalia also makes it clear that his decision only addresses the FDA regulations contained in 21 CFR section 808.1 sub D sub 1. Justice Scalia does not address other subsections of section 808.1, although he acknowledges, quote, an agency's reading of its own rules is entitled to substantial deference, close quote. As amicus, it is incumbent upon the association to respectfully point out that the FDA opines in 21 CFR 808.1 sub 2 that 360KA, quote, does not preempt state or local requirements that are equal to or substantially identical to requirements imposed by or under the Act. Left unanswered in Regal, in other words, is the question as to whether properly tailored and limited state actions for damages by negligence or otherwise may be equal to or substantially identical to requirements contemplated in Section 360KA. Also left unanswered are questions such as whether or not Wisconsin Statute Section 100.18 is preempted. Additionally, there is the issue of ambiguities inherent in Section 360K. The association respectfully commends to this court's attention the decision of Judge Sankovitz below at pages 16 to 20 of his decision. In that, in those pages, he expresses some regret for the decision he had to make because he is concerned about how preemption is being treated under cases such as Regal and otherwise. He states in part, quote, the term requirement is a poor choice to express some intent to preempt lawsuits, and the willingness of courts to attribute that intent to Congress seems contrary to the overarching principle that courts not find preemption unless Congress has unmistakably so ordained, close quote. As recognized by Justice Crooks in Meagle versus Shadoff at 2005, Wisconsin 151, this court has the power and the duty to decide the scope of preemption in Wisconsin. In Wisconsin, according to Justice Crooks, there is a strong presumption against preemption. Relying in part on Justice Felix Frankfurter, Justice Crooks made it clear in Meagle that it is important to construe federal legislation so as to avoid any needless encroachment on state authority, thus ensuring a proper balance in our federalist system. It is submitted by the association that all preemption issues are, in fact, fact-intensive. The association strongly urges that whenever a preemption challenge is asserted, it should be evaluated against a full factual background following a jury trial. And thus, the association respectfully urges this court to remand this case for that purpose so that it will have the proper predicate to exercise the power detailed by Justice Crooks and Meagle. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Weissner.
Chief, his time isn't up. Could I have a question?
Sure. You're subject to questioning, Mr. Sure. Weissner.
And that is, I'm looking at Judge Fine's dissent. He says the majority asks the wrong question, and that the question is whether Medtronics is protected by the preemption doctrine when it had the option under federal law of selling two approved devices in order to clear its inventory of obsolete, less safe devices. In my view, it does not. If I recall your brief, although I don't have it in front of me, it tracks that.
It does, Justice.
Okay. And so
We're not changing our position up here. We're simply amplifying on the fact that preemption is fact-intensive, and to get to that question that the Justice just asked, it's important that we have a full factual record because preemption affects adversely the rights of the Wisconsin citizenry and the Wisconsin lawmakers to their own way under the federalist system. And so a fact-intensive issue such as this should be explored against the fact.
Well, do you read the complaint in this case as indicating that the corporation violated FDA regulations in failing to report timely information or violated other federal regulations that would have required more disclosure? Because that's a different claim than I understand in this case. And in In Re Medtronics, which was a District Court Minnesota 2006 case,
yes, Chief
the court there said, hey, you're in a different area when you're talking in effect that there was violations of federal rules here.
Well, Chief Justice, as I understand the complaint, and the record is not, we're not going to try and comment on the record extensively because that would be the appellant's position. But as I understand the complaint, it also pleads common law negligence. It doesn't only claim that there were violations of FDA rules. And I think that whether or not those type of claims are preempted can only really be determined after a full jury trial and an opportunity for all of the facts to be brought forward after discovery.
But it's not on all fours with the Minnesota case.
I don't think it is, Chief Justice.
Okay. Just checking. Thank you. Thank you, counsel. Attorney Robert Friedbert, you'll have a motion.
Good morning. I'm Robert Friedbert, and it's my pleasure to introduce Michael Brown of the law firm of Reed Smith, who will be presenting the argument on behalf of Medtronic.
Mr. Brown, you're a licensed lawyer in the state of California?
I am, Your Honor.
And in good standing?
I am in good standing,
and
Your
Honor. And you wish to appear here for purposes of arguing this case on behalf of Medtronic?
I do, Your Honor.
You are granted permission to argue the case, and so for about a half hour, you are authorized to appear in a Wisconsin court on this case.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. It's my privilege to be here in the Fox River Valley. May it please the court, Michael Brown on behalf of defendant and respondent Medtronic. This case, including the federal statute at issue, is controlled by the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Regal and fits within Regal's parameters for the following four reasons. Number one, the device that Mr. Blunt actually received, because it went through the pre-market approval process, a process that applies only to about 1% of all medical devices, did in fact create federal requirements concerning the safety and effectiveness of the device, as Regal has stated.
Say that again.
Because Mr. Blunt's device went through the pre-market approval process, Regal tells us that it created federal requirements concerning the safety and effectiveness of the device. And second, the state law claims being alleged here, which unquestionably challenge the safety and effectiveness of the device, create state requirements, as that term is used in preemption jurisprudence and in the express preemption provision, that are different from or in addition to the federal requirements, thereby drawing a conflict. Third, plaintiff's argument and novel interpretation of the term requirement draws no support from Regal, from the medical device amendments, or any other statutory or case law, and I'll talk about that in more detail, but fourth, there is no other exception to preemption, as articulated in Regal, that applies here. Specifically, there is no violation of federal requirements here. Plaintiff conceded it today and throughout this litigation.
I just have to interrupt you for a moment. It seems to me we're using the word requirement in several different ways here. Even though a company gets pre-market approval for selling a device, they are not required to sell it.
You're absolutely right, Your Honor. We're not required to sell or manufacture any device.
Right.
I think the question is that if we elect to sell a device, we must do so. We can only sell a device that has been approved by the FDA, and as Regal says, we have to do it with almost no deviation at all.
All right.
The way
and that includes a device that the company has told the FDA has a real problem and that the company wants to substitute a part thereof.
Well, Your Honor,
that's your theory. You're protected anyway.
Well, as long as the PMA approval remains in place, and FDA, which clearly has the power to recall, in fact, the Regal Court said that the FDA must recall it if it determines that it's unsafe. And I think we've had some factual inaccuracies here today with respect to what went on here. When Medtronic filed a PMA supplement. And again, that is something that occurs all the time and is very much anticipated. In fact, there's a specific code of federal regulation that does it. And as Mr. Cabanis said, the original Chai battery was actually the 29th, not the 23rd supplement. That replaced an existing battery. The new
and the company can sell all the other 28, even though the company has said they're not very good.
No, but I think that's the problem, Your Honor, is that this is not a situation of them not saying it's not very good by any means at all. And I think it's important factually just to put it in context here.
What did they say?
What they said was that in bench testing, highly accelerated testing of batteries, meaning 300 times what a patient would ever get over 8 days instead of 3 to 7 years. All batteries will expire, if you will, in 3 to 7 years. That they found a potential shorting mechanism. Now, everyone knows batteries can short, but what they didn't know was whether this situation could ever be replicated in a human because they were doing it at this 300 times. And so over several months, still weren't able to replicate that and had no instances where it actually happened in the field. And so at the time they sent in the application, they said it was to make the battery more robust and to enhance safety. By definition, to get a PMA supplement, the device has to affect safety and effectiveness, or else you can't get a PMA supplement. So again, all of these, sometimes they change electrical components. They are all done to enhance, but this was not a situation where they had a, quote, problem on their hands. So at the time, in October of 2003, there was essentially zero risk because there had been nothing happening in the field. At the time of Mr. Blunt's surgery, there had been one field return where it had happened, which, and again, and the recall, which was actually a voluntary action taken by the company. The FDA did not recall this product. And that was in February of 2005.
Counsel, on the point that you're just addressing now, you indicate this was only one incident at the time that it happened. I look at paragraph 24 of the Court of Appeals opinion, the dissent, and there it says that Medtronic's lawyers said that preemption at oral argument. Medtronic's lawyers said that preemption would shield it from liability even if the mortality rate were 80%. And I see nothing in the record or in the majority opinion that leads me to believe that the answer of Medtronic's lawyer would be any different if 85 persons out of 100 were to die, or 90 or 95. Or 100%. So does it, is that correct? Was that your response at oral argument? The response of Medtronic's at oral argument?
Well, Judge Fine posed that hypothetical and said, would preemption apply under those hypothetical facts? The fact is that the legal principles and the framework that Regal establishes applies regardless of the facts, which makes hypothetical facts, which frankly couldn't occur here, always stretch the legal principle and seem unfair. But there were checks and balances built into the system.
So when I heard your response saying there was only one, it seemed inconsistent with the response to the hypothetical here. So could you explain
I'm trying
that?
To just provide reality, and that is what the record is that at the time of Mr. Blunt's surgery, there had been only one.
Field test.
Where a patient returned it, where it actually happened in a human. In February of 2005, and I think this shows the unrealistic aspect of Judge Fine's hypothetical, and that is when the company voluntarily took its action in February of 2005, there had been 9 instances where the shorting occurred. No injuries had taken place. These were detected upon routine interrogation, and just for the record, not that it's determinative of preemption, but Mr. Blunt's device did not have the device. But at that time, when they took the voluntary action, it was a 1 in 87,000, 0.01% of the risk. Now, I admit that's greater than the risk of being struck by lightning, but it's less than the risk of drowning. So here the system worked.
I got to slow down. I don't know if it's me or...
Your Honor, in the sense that just Judge Fine's hypothetical was that 80% mortality. Now, The device could not have been approved because it goes through what the Regal Court said was this rigorous process. If, in fact, it created a mortality rate, that it never would have gotten to that point. And so, and here we have the device being withdrawn voluntarily when the risk is 0.01%. So, again, hypothetical facts that can't occur certainly make the legal principle seem unfair, but the framework is the same regardless of the facts.
Preemption would apply regardless of the number.
Yes, Your Honor, it would.
That was my question.
If the FDA didn't take action, but again, as Regal says, the FDA must recall it if it deems that the device is unsafe. And here we have a situation. The way Regal characterized the claim
Before you get into that, I have one further question. That's this. The second point that you raised dealt with, you started out with 4 points.
Yes, Your Honor.
That the requirement, the state requirements are different, and he went on. Is the state requirement here the jury verdict?
Yes, Your Honor, it is. And that there was a lot of litigation in preemption jurisprudence that led up to Regal where that was a debate. But actually, the state requirement prong of preemption had actually been decided by the U.S. Supreme Court even before Regal.
Okay, so I just want to slow down. I got it now. The state requirement you're talking about is the jury verdict. So I want to look at the statute. 360K. A. General rule. And it says, except as provided in sub B of this section, no state or political subdivision. So you could put in here no jury verdict, because that's what the
Supreme Court said, yes, Your
Honor. So no jury verdict of a state may establish or continue in effect with respect to a device intended for human use any requirements, and then there's one, sub 1 and sub 2. Then it goes on B. Exemption requirements. Upon application of a state, now we've just determined that state here means jury verdict, right? So I'm just trying to figure out how this statute is, this rule works. On application of a jury verdict or a public, a political subdivision thereof, the secretary may, by regulation, promulgate. How in heaven's name does a jury verdict make application to a secretary?
Let me try to explain, Your Honor. There are a couple of ways that there could be a state requirement. One could be that the Wisconsin legislature enacted a provision. That's
sure.
The language that you're talking about.
That's right.
Then the question came
up. Is that applicable here?
No, it's not
okay.
applicable here.
So we're talking about a jury verdict,
right?
Right?
And so that was the question that the courts wrestled with and the Supreme Court put to rest in Regal was, but what about a jury verdict? Does that impose a state requirement, in other words, for state common law tort duties? And the Supreme Court in Regal said yes.
Does it make any sense? Does it make any sense that a jury verdict would make application to the secretary for an exemption?
No, Your Honor, that doesn't. Again, those are two different things. One is whether a state wanted to pass its own regulation.
Sure. It makes sense when the state has a regulation, but it makes no sense. B makes no sense when your state requirement is a jury verdict when you read these two together.
That issue was actually, Regal framed the question in that regard and put it this way. They characterized the claim there as saying that the plaintiff was alleging that Medtronic's device violated state law, notwithstanding the fact that it complied with federal requirements. So too is the case here. The effect of plaintiff's theory would be that it would be a violation of Wisconsin law to sell the device with the original battery when it's permissible to do so under federal law. That's what Regal said creates the classic conflict, and in that situation, state law must yield. And in Regal, the court preempted all of the plaintiff's claims, and I think because Regal controls here, the same result would be.
Counsel,
and,
if I may ask you a question. In Regal, was there a subsequent device that they could sell that was approved, like we have here? We have two apparently approved devices. In Regal, was there a balloon catheter that also was the new, improved, better model that they could sell?
Not the exact facts, Your Honor, except that their Medtronic, for example, makes several different types of balloon catheters. Here, it makes several different types of defibrillators. For example, Mr. Blunt got a device that's called a single-chamber device. It only provides treatment to the ventricles. It also makes a device that addresses both the atrium and the ventricles, a dual chamber. And under plaintiff's argument, I think you could say you had no, quote, requirement to sell the single chamber because I think that the dual chamber is safer. And in this situation, we have so in Regal, for example, it too was a PMA supplement. And so the issue about whether a PMA supplement has any different preemptive effect, I think, was dealt with by the Supreme Court in Regal. But certainly there, the allegation could have been you could have sold one of Medtronic's other catheters. And
that wasn't the allegation in Regal.
It was the allegation in Regal was that it was a defect that had arisen after the fact. And that goes to the point you raised with Mr. Kavanaugh, Justice Ginsburg's footnote. And there, again, Justice Ginsburg was the only dissenting justice in Regal. But again, the majority opinion made no distinction between defects that allegedly come up after the fact versus before. In fact, the alleged defect in Regal came about after approval. In fact, approval is a predicate to get preemption. So every preemption case, including all the circuit court decisions that preceded Regal, involve situations where the defect came about after approval.
Mr. Brown, let me ask you what your response is to the suggestion made by Mr. Gleisner that this case should be remanded to develop a further factual record.
Your Honor, that issue has been raised from the time of the trial court and waived on several occasions here. And that is that Judge Sankovitz held two different hearings and, in fact, asked plaintiff's counsel whether or not he wanted to turn this into a Rule 56F-type proceeding, and, again, didn't do that. What Judge Sankovitz then did was ordered that Medtronic produce certain documents concerning the testing, concerning the battery, and we had a three-month hiatus between hearings. And at no point through either motion for reconsideration, notice of appeal, argument in the Court of Appeal, or up until the last brief here, has there been any argument by the plaintiff that, in fact, this case should be sent back. So that issue has been waived not just once, but on multiple occasions. And there is no allegation of a violation of federal requirements here. So, and that is the only exception that Regal really provided for, because in that situation, there would not be requirements that are different from the federal requirements. They would merely be parallel to. An example of that would be if Mr. Blunt's device was not manufactured according to the FDA-mandated manufacturing process, then there wouldn't be a conflict because we wouldn't have been in compliance with the federal requirements, and they just would be parallel. And the same is true for the design, and the same is true for the warnings. That isn't this case.
And that's why it's not in Re Medtronic, District Minnesota case.
Exactly, Your Honor. There was an allegation of a violation of federal requirements.
Of failing to give full information or a kind of fraudulent information.
Yes and no. They were saying that they violated certain manufacturing and some others. The argument about failing to give the FDA information is separately would be preempted under the implied preemption doctrine in a case called Buckman, U.S. Supreme Court case called Buckman versus Plaintiff's Legal Committee. I think Justice Rogensack hit it also that the Geyer case is a relevant factual example. In that case, the argument was you had no, quote, requirement to sell two different devices. There it was a situation of seat belts versus airbags, and the plaintiffs asserted that by not selling a car that had airbags in it was a tort claim. And the U.S. Supreme Court said, no, the federal government has permitted sale of several different types of passive restraint systems, and so for you to, under state law, say that only one of them is appropriate would create that state-federal conflict. That's the situation we'd have here because, again, and the court below talked about this as well as even in Regal, and that is a state, the Wisconsin legislature would not be permitted to come up with a statute that said only the device with the modified battery could be sold. And so the court said, so then why would we allow a jury verdict to do that? And again, that's really the policy issues that go with the medical device amendments. There's two aspects of it.
Counsel,
Judge Fine hit on only one.
This is a dangerous question for me because I'm going to preface it with, tell me the errors of my ways. Let me count the ways, probably. This federal legislation, when passed in the mid-70s, was to protect people, to help protect citizens of the state of Wisconsin and around the country. And now I find in preparing for this case that the statute is being used for preemption to give immunity for selling a less safe product to the people of the state of Wisconsin. Traditionally, tort law has been our state court jurisdiction. So it seems as though, I mean, I feel like I'm being stood on my head with this case, that the statute's purpose is now a double-edged sword, and that what has been this court's bailiwick for years is now actually surprising to me. I last night I also went through the restatement of torts third and all the commentary, and I'll tell you, you come from California, that's where, you know, this stuff all started. It would be a surprise to the people who wrote this. You don't find anything that would support the Regal application in the restatement of thirds or all of the articles they cite that would support your position. So help me. No problem, Justice Bradley. You know, just take it easy. It's fine.
Let me try, Your Honor. Again, this is a doctrine that applies to a very, very select group of medical devices, about 1%. So not every device on the market gets the benefits of preemption. And the reason is that this goes through a process of approval and checking of safety and effectiveness that's different than other medical devices. And with respect to the policy issue you identified about protecting injured consumers, that was one part of the policy identified. And in the majority opinion in Regal, and as other courts have said, there is another aspect of that. And that is to encourage manufacturers to continue to update and innovate without the risk of being subject to 50 different states' tort laws. And as the majority opinion in Regal said, the solicitude of the injured consumer, in Congress's estimation, was overcome by the solicitude of patients who are getting benefits from this device. I guarantee that Mr. Blunt's life has been saved, maybe on multiple occasions, by having this device in there. And I think one of the other problems that makes it difficult is that this idea that it was an unsafe device. Again, at the time the new approval came, it hadn't been determined that this could ever even happen in real life. And so this was not a situation of, oh, my God, we have a problem. This was a continuing innovation upgrade, which happens all the time. And as it relates to what the FDA could have done, in the approval letter, which is in the record at Supplemental Appendix 213, it says you may begin to commercially distribute the new battery, we'll call it that. Now, it certainly and then lists about four pages of conditions of approval, which include a host of post-approval requirements. In other words, once it's done, we still have to report. So if there's a serious injury that occurs, within 5 days we have to report, and there's a host of other things. Now, the FDA could have said in that approval letter, you may begin to commercially distribute the new battery, and please stop distributing the old battery. So the idea that they never considered it, I just don't think is factually accurate. And again, as the Regal Court says, if they feel it's unsafe, the FDA must withdraw it from the market.
Well, one of the issues, and I just don't see how it plays into this, is there's been, as you probably know, significant criticism of the FDA. They're understaffed, criticism. They're underfunded, criticism. The criticism is that they're captive of the industry, that they're not doing the job carefully because of understaffed and underfunded. First of all, I don't know if any of that's true, but it is criticism. Does that have any play in our decision, number one? My second part of my question is, are there examples where they give supplemental PMAs and they say, and take the first 22 PMA devices off the market?
Your Honor, let me answer the second question first. I can't cite you to an example. I know that there have been instances where PMA withdrawal has either occurred. It certainly has occurred with drugs. We know that. And someone asked earlier about whether—
At the same time as the supplemental or later?
Later, Your Honor.
Yeah, that's why I'm asking you. So they don't really appear to go back and look.
Well, I think what they do, Your Honor, is that they look and see what the nature of the change is. And if they feel the nature of the change is such that it really affects, in a negative way, safety and effectiveness, they can merely say, wait a minute, you had a problem with this, do not sell it. And that's the same situation that counsel referred to in the Scott versus SEPA Vision case, which factually is actually exactly on all fours to this case. But to your other question about the FDA, it doesn't really come into play with respect to a preemption analysis, because what it amounts to, whether all of us in the room may have treated this situation a little bit differently, whichever way you'd want to deal with it, that amounts to a second guessing of the FDA's decision-making process, which the Supreme Court again has said would be impliedly preempted. Now, with respect, again, this is a very limited group of devices, and so yes, FDA has been criticized for it. Interestingly, the manufacturers don't feel like FDA is some lapdog. When an FDA calls, everyone's attention gets happened. And in fact, one of Medtronic's competitors had a situation where they allegedly failed to report certain adverse events. Ultimately, they got a $93.1 million fine and the business was shut down. So this idea that they don't pay attention really isn't borne out in real life.
If there was no preemption, why wouldn't a Medtronic, absent any kind of arguable moral consideration, simply have the incentive to foxhole any new developments or any new improvements and wait until their inventory has run down as a natural result of the operation of the marketplace and then come out with the new advanced product?
That's the true irony here, Your Honor, from a policy situation, is if we had never taken this voluntary, proactive action, then the original device batteries would be out there. We have no confirmed injuries with the original device battery. We have a number of instances where there was shorting was found during routine interrogation. But despite that, if those people filed lawsuits, we would have the benefit of preemption.
Isn't that what the doctrine of preemption is there to bolster? The idea that we're not going to create incentives for companies such as Medtronic to foxhole new developments?
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, the second part of the policy issue, in addition to protecting consumers, is to encourage this innovation and to have people be forthright and make changes and do the right thing before there is a problem, before there ever gets to the hypothetical situation that Judge Fine.
Then if preemption wasn't found, what incentive would Medtronic or other companies have not to do that?
From a legal perspective, none, other than, you know, doing the right thing, which is something the company believes it did in this circumstance. And again, I think that's where the difference is factually in terms of, you know, calling it an unsafe product.
Seems to me if you've got a product out there, then you get information that says this product was going to short, but I'm going to sell it anyway because I don't want to take a loss. Then somebody is injured, I think you have potentially liability. It's like Pinto, where the company knew that this gas fuel would explode, and they decided, well, they're not going to fix the Pinto because they'll pay damages.
Right.
And save money.
You're exactly right, Your Honor. And again, that's why these companies don't do that. And that's why that Medtronic took voluntary action.
Well, how can I be right and Judge Gableman be right at the same time?
The thought crossed my mind, Chief Justice.
I'm happy to be here for the first, time that that's occurred. But, Your Honor, again, that's...
it can't be. The two questions are inconsistent.
Well, Your Honor, no. With respect to that situation... again, here we have a situation where what the record shows is that Medtronic acted when there was a risk of 0.01% and where the instance of a shorting, even without injury, had occurred 9 times. There is an industry rate of problems with these defibrillators that is about 1%. In fact, Judge Rosenbaum, the district court in Minnesota, who was mentioned earlier, came out with an opinion on August 18th, just a month and a half ago, in a Medtronic defibrillator case, and in fact said there are many, many reasons why a defibrillator can fail, separate and apart from negligence. And if the plaintiff is arguing that PMA approval is a guarantee that the device is absolutely safe, that is absolutely not the right situation, and that Regal says it is a cost-benefit analysis.
Was the Pinto case a preemption case?
No, Your Honor, it was not.
Well, then isn't that the real distinction between the two questions?
Well, you know, it is, Your Honor. I mean, we were talking about if preemption didn't apply. That's the difference.
Didn't hear that preface. Okay.
So with respect to, Your Honor,
Could I ask a factual question? I just don't understand this. On December 17th, 2002, there was this PMA. Were there PMAs before that on this product?
Yes, Your Honor. The December 2002 PMA supplement was where they added what we have been calling the original battery. That became the new battery at the time. It replaced an existing battery. That battery wasn't unsafe, but it was felt that the Chai battery was an upgrade. It was new. It was enhancing overall safety and effectiveness. Did that make the other battery unlawful to be sold? No. So that was actually the 29th supplement on this PMA. The battery we're calling the new battery for purposes of this litigation was actually the 38th supplement. And right now, I think there have been about 75 supplements altogether. Again, tweaks here and there, but all affect safety and effectiveness, or else they wouldn't be a PMA supplement under 814.39.
So really, the issue here is not simply two dates in 2002 and 2003, but really it affects incremental improvement over years.
That's right, Your Honor.
Dozens of products.
And one of the arguments that...
Thousands.
Yes, Your Honor. One of the arguments before Regal was whether or not a PMA supplement had the same preemptive effect as the original PMA. Again, Regal was a PMA supplement case, and that issue has been dealt with. Let me just conclude, if I may, since my time is up.
Very quick, short sentence, please.
When the case started, the question was whether Wisconsin was going to follow the majority view in the circuits about preemption. Since then, Regal has come down and has decided this issue. And now we have a situation where, under the plaintiff's theory, it would be impermissible to sell the device with the original battery in Wisconsin, despite it complying with federal law. Regal tells us that that's a conflict and that state law must yield, and therefore the claims are preempted. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel.
Mr. Cabanis?
Thank you. First of all, it's not correct that we haven't asserted the argument that we're making to you here today from the beginning. We did. Judge Sankovitz issued his ruling. It was very detailed. He did a good job. I enjoyed arguing it. And right after his decision came out, we moved for reconsideration, saying we agree with your preemption analysis if the Court of Appeals cases are correct. We agree with your analysis. But here we've got one device and two different options. We made that motion in front of Judge Sankovitz for reconsideration before his dismissal. Also, all the way up the line, we've made that argument, including in the petition for review to this court,
We asked that the case be held in abeyance pending Regal, but we also knew there was a substantial probability that decision would come down as it has. So this is not some new argument. To go to the public policy issues for a moment, those are fun to discuss. Many years ago in a different lifetime, a long time ago, 30 years ago, I was an engineer. I worked for General Motors at its proving ground in Milford, Michigan. I worked in the Safety and Research Development Lab. And at General Motors, my experience was when we were improving fuel system designs, when we were improving restraint system designs, we were driven and we were provided money by management based on what we projected our profits were going to be on that car. We weren't looking back, and I won't name the bad cars we looked at with the bad fuel systems for the early 70s.
Oh, I'd
probably be violating some kind of engineer employer privilege. But the reality is, when it came to safety and safety improvements, we were motivated by the profit we were going to make in the profit place, and we wanted to compete with Lee Iacocca's safety charges for Chrysler. And it's the same thing here. To think that without preemption, Medtronic wouldn't have any marketplace incentive to provide the best and the safest products for our doctors to have available to offer to you, I just think is not giving due credit to the power of the marketplace and the power of the marketplace to drive safety.
Well, there might be a little more consumer choice between a type of automobile and a type of defibrillator, but
I'm not sure there should be.
Well, there may. The reality of the situation is there probably is. But anyway, I guess I want to go back to Regal. And I'm curious to know, in your estimation, how does your client get out from under the holding in Regal that a jury verdict would, in fact, be tantamount to the creation of a new common law duty or set of duties and hence be inconsistent with the CFRs?
Because here, Medtronic was not required to sell the device because of the PMA supplement.
But nor were they required to remove it.
They weren't required to move it, and I thought it was interesting that Medtronic's counsel acknowledged that not one time, to his awareness, is he aware of a PMA supplement being approved and prior supplements withdrawn. That does not happen. He acknowledged that. So does the FDA, under its rules and regulations, have the power to do that? Yes. I agree. Do they? No. Does Medtronic know of a single instance where they've exercised that power? No.
Counselor, what interests me more is a little bit more on the question I tried to ask you before. And let me read to you what's troubling me about Regal.
Okay.
And what I think I'm hearing you say, and if I'm hearing it wrong, I want you to correct me because that's the genesis of my question.
Okay.
As I understand your argument, you're saying once there's a supplemental approval, the initial PMA is no longer a federal requirement, right?
Correct.
Okay, so I read to you from the majority opinion, the language of the statute does not bear Regal's reading. The MDA provides that no state may establish or continue in effect with respect to a device any requirement relating to safety or effectiveness that is different from or in addition to federal requirements citing 360KA. Now, this was a supplemental device that we were looking at here, and they called that approval of that supplemental device a federal requirement. I hear you saying it's not a federal requirement, and that's what I'm having trouble lining up your argument with what I see as one holding from Regal. Can you help me out?
The supplemental PMA approval is the federal requirement. Medtronic has to meet the requirements of that supplemental PMA approved by the FDA.
I'm not concerned about the supplemental approval. I'm concerned about whether the first PMA ceases to become a federal requirement upon the supplemental approval.
Absolutely.
All right, but how do you line up that argument with what's in Regal? I'm not.
It all goes back to the use of the word required and requirement. They weren't required to sell this device.
They're never required to sell it. The question is whether it is a federal requirement if you choose to sell it.
They, they were not federally required to sell the original PMA device.
That isn't my question.
In fact, that's the reason they get the PMA supplement.
My question is not that, Counselor. I don't want to be argumentative, but I'm having some trouble being sure I really understand what you're saying. When you get a PMA approval, it is under the parlance of Regal a, quote, federal requirement. That becomes a term of art, okay? PMA approval equals federal requirement, okay? What I hear you saying is once you get a supplemental approval, the first federal requirement now becomes permission. It ceases to become a federal requirement.
In the spirit of debate, let me ask this rhetorical question to see if we can have a meeting of the minds, and I don't mean to sound antagonistic. In your view, is it one device or two devices? When you have an original device and the company comes along and says we're going to make all these changes to the same device, for purposes of the Regal analysis, is it your position that we're dealing with two separate devices?
You know what? You're
like
the lawyer and I'm the judge.
I know.
We really have to work on that premise,
But I think that's the critical distinction here.
Let me
ask you a factual question.
Okay.
In Regal, was the device that was in issue the last supplement? In this case, it is not. So is it the last supplement device? Yes or no?
Yes.
Okay. And in this case, your argument is what was sold was not the last supplement. Therefore, these two cases are different. Is that your argument?
Yes.
Thank you.
And just briefly, because my time...
I think your time is up.
Okay.
I think you ought to stay with the successful answer.
Probably a good counsel.
Thank you,
counsel. That concludes our session on 06 AP 1506, Blunt versus Medtronic, Inc. The court will recess. But before we do, for those of you who wish to continue